Hello, listeners. Welcome to Western Section Podcasts, the podcast for wildlifers. I am your host, workshop manager Ivan Parr, and I'm here with my co-host, the student affairs co-chair and North Coast chapter rep, Lizzie Meisman.
Hey, folks.
For our Get to Know the Board series, we are interviewing the Western Section treasurer. But don't go away. Our treasurer, John McNerney, has a very interesting background, and his day job is one of the more unique wildlife professions that I know of, biologist for the city of Davis. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Appreciate it, and I'm happy to be here, and appreciate that intro.
Wonderful to have you, and I'm sure the listeners are excited to hear about your fascinating job on the board, but also in real life. And I'm going to start with the most difficult question in our list, and that is, John, what is your favorite animal?
That is actually quite a difficult question, and I have to admit that I gave this some thought, and I'm gonna go ahead and say that it's a raptor, and I'm split between Swainson's hawks and burrowing owls. I think they both have a uniqueness to them that really captures my interest. But if I had to pick between the two, I would say Swainson's hawk. They just capture my imagination. I've worked with them quite a while. Their social interactions and behaviors, and then the magnificent migration that they endure every year. Not to take anything away from burrowing owls, of course, they migrate quite extensively, at least some of them do. But the Swainson's hawks are just, they're the ones that really have captured my heart and my imagination, and I think about them a lot. So I would say it's the Swainson's hawk.
So Lizzie's smiling, perhaps because she knows that the Swainson's hawk is my least favorite animal. And, but I'll say that, John, you've turned me away from that a little bit and listening to how you've perceived them.
Well, good. And hopefully someday we can sit down over maybe a cold beverage and I'll convince you even further. Some of the experiences I've had have been pretty magical with them.
Would you be willing to give just one exciting anecdote about the Swainson's hawk?
Well, so as many biologists probably know who work with them, they're one of the few, if not the only raptor that can consume prey items on the wing. So while they're flying, most other raptors need to perch or settle down in order to articulate down to pull their prey item apart and consume it. Whereas Swainson's hawks can do this on the wing while they're flying. So they can capture a grasshopper or an animal, and while flying, they can articulate their legs up and munch on them. So that's pretty cool. Now, to see them do that en masse, playing soccer, if you will, not really soccer, more like keep away. So a lot of times when there's some sort of disturbance to a grassland, like a fire or mowing or flooding, the prey items become more available. So the Swainson's hawks will key in on that availability and each other's presence. And so they'll fly in from all corners of the valley, literally, to like a smoke plume, let's say. If there's a grassland fire, they'll be attracted to that. Or it could be they've learned that a tractor is rolling through an agricultural setting, maybe mowing grass or harvesting alfalfa, and they'll come in hundreds of Swainson's hawks at a time, looking for the voles and the snakes and the lizards and the other things that are running out from safety from either whatever that disturbance is. And it's pretty fascinating to watch when one Swainson's hawk grabs a prey item, say a vole, and takes off with it. All the others in that vicinity, the chase is on, they're after it. And the aerobatic prowess, the amazing ability of them to articulate their bodies and flip around, and in some instances, even let go of the prey item just to get the other hawks off their back, while then they swoop down and around to pick it off midair once again, and fly off, almost kind of confusing or otherwise fooling their pursuers into chasing some, going some opposite direction while they circle back around and grab that prey item. So that's pretty amazing to me. That sort of, behavior.
Sounds like you're describing is a piratical, gluttonous, disturbance profiteer coming in and in agricultural fields, fires, picking off other endangered species and beating each other up.
Yep, that's life in the big city.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Right? Now they do eat burrowing owls, right? So it's
You're not making this any better.
Yeah, I know. I had to put a pin in that bubble. Is that my second favorite probably is at the mercy of their presence, but. Either way, they're both interesting species.
Yeah, that's a beautiful description. I'm really surprised that you don't like them, Ivan. I would have figured that pelicans were your least favorite animal. Pelicans, why do you hate Svensson's hawk?
Oh, we'll go into it in a different podcast. But
convince you.
I'll be glad to. I'd basically say what John said, except in a sad way. He knows how to make it sound interesting. So,
well, thanks. I look forward to hearing that story. John, what was your first job? And we'd be interested to hear in general, as well as within the wildlife field.
So those who don't know me, I am a bit of a gearhead. I like mechanics and automotive mechanics in particular. That's my hobby on the side. And it has been for a long time. And even since I was a young person. And so my first job actually was related to that. My official title was a petroleum transfer technician, not a gas pumper, which you might immediately go to, but someone who changed oil. I worked at an express lube facility to do Speedy Lube or one of these that do very quick oil changes, tire changes, all the lubricants on the car, etc. So that was my first paid job back as a high school senior, I believe. And my first real wildlife job was as a seasonal wildlife biologist for the Tahoe National Forest, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Tahoe National Forest, on the what used to be called the Forest Hill Ranger District. I'm not sure what it is now, but things have changed a little bit since then. And that was mostly chasing around spotted owls and mesocarnivores, specifically looking for Fisher, Martin, hopeful for Sierra Nevada Red Fox at that lower stretch of the Sierra, and then trying to track or trace Wolverine, which hadn't been sighted on that district in a long time. So I spent a lot of time running around the woods out there with other biologists, and it was a great gig. I really enjoyed it.
Wow,
it's
really interesting. Really interesting coupling of early career.
Quite different, right? Automotive side and then the biological side. But wildlife biology has been actually, it's been in my heart since I was a very young man. I think I even knew when I was one of the lucky ones. I knew in high school that I wanted to pursue wildlife biology as a career. And so I set that course and stayed on it.
And we're lucky that you did, because here you are. The next of our standard questions, and this is one that Lizzie submitted a while back. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Wow, yeah, that one I think is, and I'm not sure where it came from, but the phrase is go slow to go fast. And I've heard it multiple times over my career, and it's really, I think it means to take your time to do things right, or at least near as right as you can the first time. If you rush through things, you can make some pretty serious errors, which have consequences across the board. And when you're dealing with wildlife, especially wildlife conservation, if you make a mistake in a management decision, it can really, really be problematic, obviously for the species, but also for the profession, and certainly in your ability to communicate the need for conservation and the success stories that the wildlife profession has to just the general public, right? So if you make a mistake, you can really do some damage there. And honestly, I think I may have heard that from my mother the first time when I was a young man. But like I said, multiple multiple supervisors along the way have had a very similar message. And I think it still rings true as being the best piece of advice, even when I tell myself inner dialogue, okay, we're going to do this right the first time.
That's really valuable, especially a reminder to any of us, regardless of career stage.
Yeah.
And my next question for you is, how long have you been involved with the Western section?
You know, I would have to count up the years, but I know I first got involved with the Western section just as a member back in 1993, I want to say. And I think I've been intermittently a member since then, till about 1999 when I've been a full-time member. But it was at the 2009 the Wildlife Society's annual conference in Monterey in 2009. I got involved with the arrangements committee on that. So that was really kind of my first leadership role, or at least more than just being a member, participatory role, if you will, in the Wildlife Society. And then shortly thereafter, immediately thereafter, I was asked to run as a section president. And then I was elected in 2010 as the president elect. And I've been on the board ever since. So serving various capacities and committees and those sorts of things, but as president, president-elect, president, past president for those 3 years, and then treasurer from then on. So, and I'm still treasurer today.
And of those roles, which would you say is the most difficult?
President-elect position as the program chair for the annual meeting, that was a lot of work. So I'm learning the section, I'm working on putting this conference program together. Luckily, though, it was one of the first years when I was the president-elect that we were relying heavily on, more heavily, I should say, on contract staff, in particular, Candace Ranger, who is our conference coordinator now and has been since then, and realizing what a wonderful job she does in the back end of planning these conferences, which took a lot of pressure and a lot of weight off of president-elect planning these things. So my attention turned more towards the development of the program, the plenary and that sort of thing, which made it a lot easier, I think, in the end. But there was still a lot of work. Yeah. So anyway, to answer that question, it was my president-elect term.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a huge undertaking for each president-elect, but especially in that transition like you were describing. And what was the biggest challenge that you've encountered as our treasurer?
I have to admit, I don't think I've really encountered a significant challenge as president and treasurer. But I know that's kind of a cop out of the question. But I'll say there is a bit of tedium involved with reviewing the various invoices and, post-conference bills, if you will, for accuracy.
That's tedious?
Yeah. It can be interesting, for a little while, but yeah, it tends to begin to grind away on you. And in fact, I make it my mission, and I'm sure you guys have probably experienced this at one point or another in the past, to really dig through invoices and make sure the receipts are matching up to what's being billed and invoiced and that sort of stuff. And so it's kind of like I try to make it a game, can I find an error in there? Not to rub it in the face of the person who submitted it, but just mentally, can I find something that can be improved here? If not, I'll just trudge forward. So anyway, that's, I think, probably the most difficult part of being treasurer.
So I kind of jokingly call you the starfish behind your back because you're kind of, I sort of see you as the keystone figure on the board because you've been involved for so long and you have so many talents and capabilities and you're eagerly do the job that I would consider the most difficult, which is treasurer. What advice would you provide to the incoming generations who are starting to get involved with the Western section?
I think I first of all say it's an exciting time, you know, especially in their lives, you know, early career professionals. You know, it can be daunting. It can be feel overwhelming at times. You know, gosh, how do I do this? I would suggest just take your time. You know, don't feel in a mad rush to get to that, you know, career position you're ultimately aiming for. Take your time to kind of work the field. Certainly stay within the profession if your interest is as a wildlife professional, but don't feel bad about kind of working around. Maybe try a job that you thought, okay, it's wildlife related, but it might not be fully engaging and interesting in what I want to do. Might be a desk job. It could be a research job where you're spending a lot of time in the library. You know, maybe you want to be a field biologist, but here you are in a lab. That's okay. That's all experience. It's going to make you a bigger, better personality, but certainly a bigger professional, or better professional and more marketable later on when you're looking for that, you know, final career spot. And you know, some people don't ever achieve that final career spot, so don't feel intimidated there. But that's the beauty of, I think, all these little, taking your time to experience and play within the field of wildlife, because it makes you way more well-rounded and adaptable. You're going to be better off when it comes down to selecting something that you do enjoy eventually. The other thing is network, you know, I mean, that is critical. And I think, you know, the Wildlife Society in the Western section of Wildlife Society, if you're a member of the Western section, great resources to do that, to network, to get engaged in these events, to meet potential employers, you know, so that's super important as well. Don't want to forget that.
Yeah, I appreciate that advice. And I think it's helpful, especially to early career professionals, to remind ourselves to be patient and not jam ourselves down a particular path too soon. My next question for you is, how has the section changed over the years that, you know, as Ivan described in your long tenure here?
You know, I think I already kind of mentioned it before, but there's definitely more reliance on contract staff. So, you know, looking to skill sets that are beyond what the volunteer board is capable of putting together. So, you know, we have a wonderful team of contractors right now, Ivan included, you know, and Candace already mentioned, you know, Cynthia, Mike Chappell, and Eric Ranger. Gosh, you know, again, I had Ranger on my tongue, but his name. But Eric, yeah, who deals with our web technology, or IT, if you will. Great group of people. You know, these are people with varying skill sets. Not all of them are wildlife professionals, but they feel, and they're part, they feel wildlife and they feel the profession and natural resources, and they're certainly part of the family here. So, that's been a huge improvement, I would say, over the years that I've been involved. I think we've done a really good job of expanding our professional development, including the workshop programs. That's, you know, before we were only eking out maybe one or two pre-conference workshops a year. But now we're, you know, somewhere in there, with the exception of 2020, it was pretty problematic for everybody around, but, you know, we're getting up there and shelling out a bunch of really important workshops that I think are topical and important for members to, you know, keep relevant, keep up to speed, and maybe even broaden their horizons a little bit. So Ivan's been doing a good job there. I definitely see better attendance at the annual meetings. I think we've had some record attendance over the last maybe 3 to 4 years, which is wonderful, because the more people that are involved in these meetings, the greater the networking opportunity for all involved, and certainly the better the benefit, right? So that's awesome. A lot more student involvement. You know, when I started, I don't recall as many students participating, and I don't know why that is. Maybe it's better marketing to them, or it could be word of mouth. You know, we made some sort of effort to produce a student affairs committee to reach out to the students, to get them communicating, get them involved. And Lizzie, you certainly might be able to speak to that because I did watch you as a wildlife student become this awesome wildlife professional. And certainly you got engaged in dissection at an early stage in your education, or later stage in your education, early stage of your profession, but certainly more student involvement. That's been pretty cool. I'm not patting myself on the back by any means. It takes a village, but I will say we are probably the strongest financially that we've ever been, as far as the section goes. And that is, again, many, many reasons why that is. I'm just, keeping tabs on the bottom line, but a lot of effort has gone into making sure that we are, balancing the budget on an annual level and trying to keep our workshops, professional development and our annual meetings is something that, and membership, something that's affordable, but valuable, but still able to help us generate some revenue to support the organization. So those are the main changes that I've seen.
And just, contemplating on that right now in 2020, you mentioned how difficult it's been. Do you have any worries about, the loss of revenue that's happened over this last year?
Of course. I mean, it's my job to worry about the section's finances, and certainly seeing quite a bit of our revenue cut out in 2020. But I think the lag will catch up to us in 2021. I think we're going to be in a bit of a tight spot as far as our operational budget. So trying to balance that budget and come out in the green. I think we'll be probably operating at a loss in 2021. We obviously expected that as a result of some of the modifications and changes, and certainly the annual meeting being virtual. Which may or may not generate the same amount of interest as it would as an in-person meeting. So I do worry that we will see a shortfall. I'm not worried overall for the section because of our financial security. We do have a healthy reserve. I think we can float through the next year or two, without significant challenge. With a little bit of loss of revenue, that's fine. But after that, I think we need to try to figure out how to, refill the tank, if you will.
All right. Well, thank you for that. But enough shop talk. It's time to explore your role as the city biologist for Davis. And, am I right in thinking that that's a really unusual job? I don't know too many biologists or many cities, really, who have a city biologist.
So, I think you're right. It's pretty unique in the sense that I can't think of another city in California that has a staff biologist. I think most will contract out to a consulting firm for the type of service that I provide the city. There is, I believe, a wildlife type biologist for either the county or city of San Luis Obispo. And I'm not certain if they are, a trained wildlife biologist or they're a resource manager that also deals with wildlife biology, but I know they deal with some habitat and wildlife issues. The only other municipality I can think of that has a staff wildlife biologist is Boulder, Colorado. And, if you look at the similarities between Boulder and Davis, there are many, college towns, very educated, a lot of wildlife in the vicinity. And those people who live there really value those natural resources, including wildlife. So I think it kind of makes sense for this community, as well as Boulder and certainly others out there, either have a staff biologist or consider having one, because it really brings a lot of that decision making to the local level, makes it homegrown, if you will. So I think, more people can get behind that.
So do you have a lot of interaction with the public?
I do. Lately, not so much, face-to-face, but certainly over the phone and via email. So almost on a daily basis, I have communications. Most of the time, it's with people who are, looking for advice on how to deal with nuisance wildlife, because we do share our backyards with wildlife. And it's the typical usual suspects, if you will, like raccoons, fox, ground squirrels, skunks, tree squirrels, coyotes, you know, the ones that we have around here that have adapted very well to urban living and certainly have habituated to living around humans and benefited from that. But they can get to a point where they're either actually causing damage to a property owner's property, or there's a perceived threat or hazard to that person's property. And either way, I spend a lot of time working with them to try to find common ground.
What's the biggest conservation issue that you deal with as the city biologist?
Mostly impact avoidance and minimization for all species, really, mostly protected. So, you know, maybe the rare or least common, certainly state or federal protected animals that live in town. And that impact is generally just human caused disturbances. And there's a wide range, you know, it could be development, but also it could be operation and maintenance of facilities and utilities. We have quite a few at the city level utilities that also are attractive to wildlife. For example, stormwater detention basins and conveyance channels. Our greenbelt system is expansive here in the city of Davis. We have lots and lots of trees and vegetated landscapes that are connected, which makes a wonderful migratory corridor all the way across and through town. So anytime we get in there to do work on that vegetation of those trees, there's potential for impact. So I do a lot of work with our own crews to try to identify and identify ways to avoid and minimize any impacts to those critters, and certainly through development review. So, you know, reviewing CEQA documents, NEPA documents, working with developers to try to, beforehand, to try to embrace some of the YOLO habitat conservation plan elements to avoid or minimize the impacts to those species as well. You know, we see a lot of protected species or you know, sensitive species here in town. You know, sorry to say, Ivan, but we do have a very high urban breeding population of Swainson's hawks here in Davis.
I know, they were in my backyard when I lived in Davis.
Yeah, so you're aware that they are, you know, they're here and they are actually, you know, quite abundant and they do quite well here in the urban forest, as do other raptors, you know, white-tailed kites and, but yeah, other raptors also live in the urban canopy here, the urban forest. But we also see things like, out at our wetlands area where we treat wastewater, we, you know, see tricolor blackbirds and giant garter snake. We have burrowing owl that live nearby as well. So trying to make sure that we're aware of where these animals are, because a lot of times they're very dynamic in their movement. So census work, keeping tabs. I keep tabs on where they're at from year to year as far as where they're breeding. And then feed that information into any planning level, or any planning that's occurring for development and or operation and maintenance of facilities.
So you mentioned the green belt. I know one of the animals that frequents the green belt and the urban forest and people's backyard is the wild turkey. And there's even a statue of a wild turkey in the green belt. How do you feel about the wild turkey?
So I have to admit, I'm not aware of that statue of the wild turkey, and I'd be curious to find out where it is. that's new to me. And I don't doubt it. I mean, we have all kinds of interesting statues and art in the Greenbelt system around here, including a dog riding a bicycle, right? And giant dominoes and all kinds of strange stuff. So how do I feel about wild turkeys? Well, you know, I think they're a fascinating animal socially. I think their social interactions are a lot of fun to watch. And I think they're, you know, they're a pretty unique bird in the ecosystem, for better or for worse. I also think they're very tasty. You know, I love wild turkey. I love to hunt them and consume them. But I will say that they do present a unique challenge in the urban environment here in the city of Davis, and they certainly keep me on my toes when it comes to managing their numbers. We absolutely see exponential growth in the population here in town. It's unchecked. There's no natural predation. These are long-lived birds, even in the wild. In captivity, they can live very long. And when you're in an urban situation where there's very little natural mortality, we do see the captive side of longevity. And they breed and breed and breed, and they do quite well. And they have very high nest survival. So fledge rate is almost 100%. I would say nestling mortality or survival rate of nestlings to breeding adults is pretty high too. I don't have a confirmed number on that, but I'll say it's well above 50%. I would say it's in the neighborhood of 70 to 80%. So very much like, you know, you might see a starling or a European, you know, house sparrow, very, very high success to become breeding adults. But that's purely in the absence of any kind of predation or mortality. There is a little bit of road collisions that occur every now and again, maybe occasional red tail or Swainson's hawk, you know, hey, Swainson's hawk's coming down and picking off the poults. But very, very little mortality on them. So we see the very steep population increase here. Management is a challenge. I'm trying to balance community interests on both sides of these birds, both the love and the hate category, if you will. So we have people who absolutely adore having the turkeys around, and we have people who absolutely don't. The turkeys present a unique challenge as far as the management because of the opposing interests from the community. So finding that common ground has been difficult, and finding a cost-effective common ground to manage these birds has also been difficult. So we do have a working relationship with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, state of California. California Department of Fish and Wildlife, to do some trap and relocation of these birds to help relieve the community of that growth. I don't think Davis is unique anymore. We certainly are seeing turkeys move into other urban areas and they're starting to create very similar problems for them. Finding some sort of solution that fits the community is very difficult with these birds, that's for sure.
Sounds like it, especially when you can't have hunting in the city limits, I take it.
No, unfortunately, hunting is not allowed in town. And, I need to be cautious with that because we do have members of this community that are very, very opposed to the consumption of animals, I suppose. People are very concerned about the welfare of animals as being fellow earthlings and having every right to exist as we do as humans. And I don't refute that at all. I don't argue even against that. But I do suggest that humans as a top predator, do have the right to access these animals for consumption. The challenge is, maybe not the challenge, but certainly the mission of all of us wildlife professionals is to ensure that that use is equal and balanced and, reasonable.
Good points. Moving on, what's your take on the Davis Toad Tunnel?
Yes, the Davis Toad Tunnel. Davis is known for many silly things, that's for sure. I wouldn't say the Toad Tunnel is one of them, though. So the Toad Tunnel is literally a culvert, steel culvert tunnel that was placed under a overcrossing, one of the overcrossings here in town, between a stormwater detention basin that was home to western toad, a large population of western toad. And that was breeding habitat for the western toad, and most of their estivation habitat was located to, I guess it would be the east of where that pond was. And so, as most of the listeners might know, western toads do some localized migration, if you will, between suitable breeding habitat and upland estivation sites. And so you might see them move en masse on certain nights where you have large number of toads moving together between those sites. And the city had decided to build an overcrossing across the Interstate 80 and the Union Pacific Railway line. And the approach ramp of said overcrossing was right in the middle of that migratory path between the aquatic reproductive habitat and the upland estivation habitat for those toads. And one of the things they quickly realized after that road went in is that the toads were climbing up and over the embankment across the street and becoming roadkill at a very alarming and high number. So it was upsetting. There was no doubt about it to see all these toads becoming squished in the road due to the new barrier in their migratory path. So council made a decision to have a toad tunnel added. So basically a pipe, and I believe they did consult a wildlife professional who said, well, the best way you're gonna do, best you're gonna be able to do is put a tunnel, like a small tunnel, a drainage channel, if you will, or drainage pipe underneath this thing to try to, you know, give a spot for these toads to move through. And unfortunately, you know, toads don't, unless they're forced by drift net or other fencing, you know, impervious fencing material, they're not going to really find that tunnel. And it's dark and it's probably hot on the apron because the apron was steel. So it's probably picking up solar radiation, and then the toads were probably avoiding that just because it was a hot entrance. And they're not going to know this is this is point A that will get me to point B. They can't really, you know, be able to see through the tunnel that there's light, et cetera. So anyway, best intentions with this tunnel. It was installed. It cost quite a bit of money to put in, and the toads avoided it. They didn't use it, and they continued to go up and over the road and die en masse. And unfortunately, that population of Western toad there extirpated. So it was again, right intention, but it failed.
And all the population is gone.
I wouldn't say it's completely gone. There's still a few toads that show up every now and again, but it wasn't in its glory. So it's not back to where it was.
I mean, you said they asked a biologist. Why didn't they go to you, the city biologist?
Well, before my time, Ivan.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, this was several years prior to me working or starting with the city of Davis. And in fact, I can't remember what year it was that they put that in, but it was, I'm going to say in the 90s. So
John, I used to live in Davis, and I remember when West Nile hit Davis and the magpie population plummeted. What are some of the changes you've seen in the wildlife dynamics in Davis?
Yeah, I, as you point out, when this West Nile virus hit Davis, I wasn't here when that occurred, and we did see the yellow-billed magpie population disappear almost nearly. We see a little bit of recovery, but they haven't quite got back to where they were here in town. I think there is hope, though, because we do see more and more breeding populations, especially over the last couple of years, and I know they're breeding around, and I see them out in the agricultural field. So there's hope that they will make some sort of recovery, but it hasn't quite happened yet. You know, the city itself hasn't changed a whole lot as far as development, which is good because, you know, no development honestly means reduced conversion of otherwise habitat, available habitat for wildlife. So the slow growth really has helped the open space and habitats of the area to remain. So that really hasn't changed a whole lot, I think, since you've been here. But what has changed in those areas is the more of an interest in controlling vegetation to reduce any kind of fire hazard, especially with drought and climate shift, where California is seeing more frequent and certainly more explosive wildfires in areas where we really didn't expect to see them. And certainly we have open space and habitat areas that are a little shaggy, it's very nice habitat, but certainly very dense and a lot of multi-layer structure, especially in the riparian areas. And those types of areas now are looked at in a different lens, especially when they're close proximity to residential structures and other, human properties. And so there is a kind of increased interest in managing those sites, maybe a little heavier handed than we might have in the past. So that certainly has changed. I would also say recorded species occurrence may have shifted a little bit since you've been here, Ivan. Eastern fox squirrel, they've really taken all corners of the city. Whereas, before in the early 2000s, they were pretty much isolated to campus, the university campus. But now we've seen them expand out, as of wild turkey. We only saw a few roaming around, and now obviously we see quite a few, as we've discussed earlier. Another interesting thing, Cooper's hawks and red shoulder hawks in the urban area have increased dramatically. We see a lot more reproduction of the both those species here in town where we hadn't before. And the main question becomes, is it because of those fox squirrels, and that remains to be seen. Western bluebirds are also a species that are in greater abundance probably than they were when you were here. A lot of that is, I think, attributed to university, their researchers doing nest box projects. Basically, that's a nest box highway is what they're calling it. And so they've worked with the city to identify spots to include a bluebird and tree swallow nest boxes, and installed quite a few of them. I'd say, 20, 25 or so. And so anyway, the reproduction in those boxes has been very successful, very high. So we're seeing a lot more birds, bluebirds around town, which is great. It's nice to see those guys. I already mentioned the yellow-billed magpies, and not recovering quite as quickly as we had all hoped, but there still is some hope there. Certainly a decrease in burrowing owls, probably since you've been here. We saw populations on campus and around the transition areas of town, but those numbers have reduced pretty dramatically. And I want to say there's a lot of coincidence the timing of it certainly overlap with their number. The decline in their number certainly overlaps with the introduction of West Nile to the area as well. So I suspect there might be some sort of factor involved with that. We have areas that we've managed nearly the same way for the last 20 plus years. Whereas 20 years ago, we had 12 breeding pairs of owls in a given location, and there's one now. Nothing's changed in the management of the habitat. The only thing that has changed really has been, disease, West Nile virus, and the conversion of maybe some of the agricultural lands around town from alfalfa, tomatoes, to orchards, a little more monotypic, long-lived. That could be a factor as well, as maybe some of their foraging habitat has been removed. But that's
maybe the alfalfa is bringing more Swainson's hawks.
That's a possibility, yeah. I think the loss of alfalfa actually is going to be detrimental to the Swainson's hawks as well. So if you're rooting for the demise of our local Swainson's hawk population, a lot of the conversion of ag lands around here from alfalfa into orchard certainly is problematic for them. The last thing that probably didn't occur too frequently, Ivan, when you were here in town, black bear occurrence. We've had black bears visit town the really? Last 2 years.
Black bear,
which is unique, obviously, and fascinating all in the same time. And mountain lions as well. We see mountain lions show up with more frequency. That could be in response to a growing deer population out in the Yolo Wildlife Area. In adjacent habitat. So there might be, have larger ungulates that are supporting their movement down here. Or it could just be the same thing, which I suspect black bears are suffering from, is loss, repetitive loss of habitat from fires up in the hills above the city here.
Wow. So really a lot of change and a lot going on and quite a lot on the plate of the city biologist of Davis.
It keeps me busy. I want to say I don't think I could have, you know, wished for a more enjoyable job. It certainly has some peaks and troughs. You know, it can be a challenge to work in a community of folks that are highly educated, and you know, some of them have very strong opinions on how wildlife and wildlife resources should be managed. So, you know, juggling those strong interests can be a challenge, but it makes it, that, I think it's that challenge which makes the job super interesting.
Well, thank you for sharing it with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for tuning in to Western Section Podcasts. It has been a pleasure meeting this show's guest, John McNerney. We'd like to thank our Oversight Committee, Program Director Cynthia Perrine, and Project Manager Candace Ringer, and our Podcast Committee, Angela Amlin, Elizabeth Meisman, and Ivan Parr. To all our members, please stay safe and healthy and be part of something wilder.